Our next case is 10-1693, Disciplinary Counsel versus Dia Lynn Character. Walton.
Good morning, Madam Chief Justice and justices. May it please the Court. I'm Gerald Walton. I'm appearing here on behalf of Respondent Dia Character. This is a very voluminous case, as we're all well aware. This case started more than a year before I was retained as counsel. I came in when it was on the third amended complaint. By the time there was a sixth amended complaint, there were 20 different counts. Several of the counts were related to one person. There were three counts relating to Rhonda Freeman, two counts relating to Jewel Jackson. Before we began the hearing, we bifurcated count number 20, which deals with Dia Character's criminal conviction, and I believe that everyone is fully aware that Dia Character is serving time in a state prison. That was bifurcated because of the appeal. The counts 2, 3, 8, 9, and 14 were dismissed. After the hearing, counts 5, 6, 7, and 11 were also dismissed. There were findings of fact and conclusions of law on number 1. That was the case of Barbara Williams. Of note here, this is a $750 matter. There were some stipulations as to what Dia Character did. In essence, what she did wrong here was she did provide the services for which she was paid $750, but she didn't put the $750 into an IOLTA account, and she spent it at her leisure. She also did not maintain insurance, nor did she tell her client that. She also did not maintain an IOLTA account at that point in time. And she also held herself out to be a lawyer with character, and associates. Those are the things that she did wrong in that case, and she acknowledged those things. She didn't hide those things. In the fourth case, fourth count deals with a bankruptcy with Mr. Rowe. That resulted from three different cases being generated for Mr. Rowe in bankruptcy court in quick succession. The first two went to another judge. The third one went to Judge Morgenstein Clarin. And as a result of that, the long and the short of it is the case was dismissed. There were some issues over filing fees. All of the filing fees were paid. And Mr. Rowe's bankruptcy, which was pending in another court, was not dismissed because it was followed through. Five, six, and seven were dismissed by the hearing panel, eight and nine by the relator before the hearing. Two counts relating to Jewel Jackson, the first of which was relating to the post-decree divorce work which was done for her, but there was other work which was done in addition to the post-decree divorce work. When Jewel Jackson came to my client, she had received the sum total of $83 from her divorce. She had paid her prior lawyer $20,000, or they had a judgment for $20,000 against her, and there were multiple assets which were never discovered prior to the time of final judgment in that divorce. My client, with the full knowledge and acquiescence of Jewel Jackson, brought in Cynthia, another lawyer, and who was more seasoned in divorce matters than my client, and they proceeded to do a great amount of work. The problem that my client had is that she can't show the records. When she did show up at the Bar Association with Ms. Rini, she had a box of very unorganized records. A great number of these records were in the possession of her co-counsel, who prior to this point in time was disbarred by this court. and was unreachable by me, and I believe she's suffering some severe depression at this point in time. We made numerous attempts to contact her, and she had the majority of the records, and she had the timesheets. In looking at whether or not the fee was excessive, we have to look as to what was done and without the records and without a bill. There's no question that there was no fee agreement, because when this Jewel Jackson came to my client, she was penniless, she was being evicted, and she was in terrible shape. She had no money to pay my client. And this is one of the problems that my client has had throughout the course of her career. When people don't have money and seriously need work, she steps to the plate for these people. And as a result of that, she is grossly overworked. She is, I will tell you, extremely unorganized. She moved her office multiple times. She had files in different places. In one particular instance, the files that she had in an office in the Agora were removed. In another particular case, she had files in a car which was repossessed, and those files were destroyed. In another particular case, she had files in a home which was torn down. But the long and the short of it is she got Jewel Jackson a total of $90-some thousand in benefits because of her discovery of two different assets, retirement assets, which took extensive discovery and it took extensive investigation because the former husband of Jewel Jackson was not forthcoming with any of this information. Unfortunately, she cannot show all the time and effort that she put into it, but Jewel Jackson benefited significantly from my client's involvement.
Counsel, it appears to me that there's a multiple-page stipulations by your client and the disciplinary counsel, and we're here to determine the appropriate sanction because
right.
That is something that was not able to be stipulated. The mitigation and the any other factors here are agreed upon as well.
Right.
The fact that she's undergoing a certain level of punishment at this point and the multiple counts as evidenced by the stipulation. So what we're here to, I guess, decide upon is the appropriate sanctions here, not the violations, because those are stipulated to. And that's what I would like to hear you address with your remaining time, is the appropriateness of a sanction for your client.
Your Honors, I believe that, first of all, the findings of fact and conclusions of law must be based upon clear and convincing evidence. I believe that the hearing panel did a good job. They worked very hard. A lot of time was spent. What I'm looking at here is the totality of what we have. Yes, we have a large volume and a large number of people, but there was an awful lot of mud thrown against the wall, and half of these cases turned out being dismissed. So we have 10 counts that we're dealing with. And when I'm looking at this, I have to look at did she steal from any of these clients? No. Did she benefit substantially economically from her dealings with any of these clients? No. Were the clients actually hurt in any way? No. There are people who have come back after the fact and said, oh, I paid too much money. Vashawn Williams. Two felonious assault counts for a black guy in Butler County, down to two misdemeanors, and he complains about a $20,000 fee when it takes a day to go down for any hearing. To go down and back requires a day spent by an attorney when they can't devote their time to anything else. I look at this. Yes, there were a number of things, but I have to also point out that there were a lot of things personally going on in this character's life.
I'm still trying to. I'm slow here. You tell us he objected to a $20,000 fee.
Yes.
And your justification for that was that your client had to spend a whole day?
No, every time my client or another lawyer went to Miami from Cleveland, an entire day was spent.
Okay.
Okay? And it wasn't one occasion. It was multiple occasions. And the result, although it didn't go to trial, did not happen in a vacuum. During cross-examination, Vashon Williams admitted he had no idea what his lawyers did. We went through chapter and verse, the docket.
Okay. I misunderstood you. I thought you were...
The fact of the matter is, though, none of these clients suffered or did not suffer substantially. Ms. Character did not run a practice well from a management standpoint. She acknowledges not having an IOLTA account most of the time, not having liability insurance most of the time, not notifying clients of this most of the time, commingling funds most of the time, but she didn't steal the funds. Nobody has complained that she stole any funds. Rhonda Williams, who was an astute investor, made $12,000 on one investment of $35,000, and she made the $12,000 within 1 month, and then she went and invested a second $25,000, and because of market sources and market factors in the real estate market at the time, that investment basically was lost.
Mr. Walton, did I hear you say that the convictions are not part of this matter? She pled guilty to 10 counts, 10 felonies.
They are not part of this matter. They were bifurcated, Your Honor, for the simple reason that she is on appeal.
But she pled guilty in 2008. The appeal is still pending?
The appeal before the Eighth Circuit or Eighth District has been decided. She on her own has opted to continue the appeal on a delayed appeal to this court. Those issues were not decided here, and she is on an interim suspension because of that conviction. I believe here that the facts of this case show that we have a very disorganized person. We have a person who played fast and loose with things because she was overwhelmed with what was going on with her life. I don't think that any of this shows any intrinsic character defects which cannot be overcome, which cannot be rehabilitated. If there were intrinsic character defects, which other than and not just practices, which were poor, that could not be rehabilitated, could not be corrected, I wouldn't be standing here before you. But I believe that she can be rehabilitated. I believe that she can be mentored and supervised. And I believe that she can be taught to how to manage a law practice correctly, how to make sure that she has things in writing for her protection and that of her clients. She made some very bad decisions here. But she was cooperative. It's pointed out in the record that she appeared for one deposition with Marianne Rini, but she appeared for two others when I was on the case with Jules Gerlach, which don't even come in here. The fact that she didn't have the records, she explained, and I think the fact that she can't find the records which are lost is not an indication of trying to evade or not comply with or cooperate with.
So, counsel, what would you have us do here?
I would ask for an indefinite suspension, Your Honor, and I think that the people who were in the best position to listen to and see the witnesses and hear the witnesses and spend the 4 days in testimony were the hearing panel, and the hearing panel itself recommended that there be an indefinite suspension. And I think that that is a correct determination. I think that she can be rehabilitated, but a disbarment, as we all know, is a death sentence as far as the practice of law. And I believe that she is suffering substantially by her imprisonment, and I believe that things will come out in that particular case, which will show that some of the things that she pled guilty to without what I consider any assistance of counsel. She had an appointed counsel on that case. I believe that those things will shed a different light on things. One of the counts which she pled guilty to had to do with the Jewel Jackson count 11. After hearing everything that transpired here, the hearing panel dismissed count 11. And that's something, based on the same facts for which Jewel Jackson pled guilty upon advice of counsel in the criminal case. Her criminal case was a travesty as far as her having any sort of representation.
But that's bifurcated. We're not to consider that.
Yes, Your Honor, that is
bifurcated. Would you suggest that we hold this in abeyance until we do consider that case?
No, Your Honor, I'm not suggesting that. I'm suggesting that we are here, and I'm suggesting that the people who are in the best position to evaluate the evidence, who heard the evidence, heard the testimony, looked at the people, are the hearing panel, which recommended indefinite suspension, and I would concur with that. That's what I recommended going in.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Ms. Hissom?
Yes, may it please the Court, Heather Hissom on behalf of Relator, the Office of Disciplinary Counsel. I would like to start today by addressing the allegations that were in respondent's brief, and then I will address what has been stated here today. For starters, this respondent in this matter was found to have violated 53 provisions of the Ohio Rules of Professional Conduct and the Code of Professional Responsibility. It did involve 10 counts, 7 different clients, and for that misconduct, permanent disbarment is the appropriate sanction. Respondent's misconduct involved not only her representation of legal clients, it involved her private activity, or separate activity, I guess I should say, as the vice president of business and legal affairs for a real estate investment firm. The misconduct contained in the complaints spans 4 separate years. The board did not find any mitigation in this case, none. But they did find a lot of aggravation. They found respondent had a prior disciplinary history, that there is a pattern of misconduct, that there are multiple offenses, that she was not remorseful for any of the misconduct. They found that her victims were vulnerable and had been harmed, and they found that she had not made restitution. At the hearing, Relator recommended a permanent disbarment. And as he states today, respondent did request an indefinite suspension. However, in the brief that was filed, respondent requested either a remand or a dismissal. In Cleveland Bar Association versus Acker, this court held that due process in a disciplinary case is met when the respondent has the opportunity to subpoena witnesses, take depositions, appear at a hearing, and make explanation for the alleged misconduct. In this case, respondent was afforded all of those opportunities. In her brief, she alleged that she has been denied due process and alleged that that has taken various forms. However, it should be noted that in the record of this case, none of those were brought before the hearing panel, put in complaints or put in answers or filed in motions. The respondent first alleges and foremost that she was prejudiced by not being able to appear at the hearing in this matter. As has been admitted today, this is because she's incarcerated. This court, in a case called In re Colburn, held that in a disciplinary case, the primary means of securing the testimony of a witness who is a prisoner should be by deposition. In the In re Colburn case, that person who is in prison happened to be the respondent. In this matter, Relator and Respondent's counsel spent 2 full days at the prison taking respondent's deposition. On one day, we were even permitted to stay past administrative closing hours to continue. That video deposition was played in its entirety for the panel in this matter. At the conclusion of all days of testimony and all witnesses, the panel and counsel returned to the prison to take an additional day of testimony from the respondent. What this proves is that not only was she afforded basic due process, but that this panel went out of its way to make sure that she had full opportunity to present her side of these allegations. Respondent was given the opportunity to submit exhibits and to call witnesses. You'll notice from the record that respondent did not call witnesses and submitted 1 exhibit. However, respondent's counsel attended all days of the hearing and cross-examined witnesses presented by the relator. The fact that the respondent did not take full advantage of the opportunity provided to her does not equate to a violation of due process. Further, the respondent has claimed that the entire process before the panel was flawed because the relator did not submit affidavits of all the grievances. In her brief, respondent relies on 2 cases, both of which involve motions for default for this proposition. Those cases are Dayton Bar Association versus Wilson Cincinnati Bar Association versus Newman. Both of those cases, again, involve motions for default and the evidence needed to prove allegations in a complaint and a motion for default. Motions for default are under a separate division of GovBar Rule 5. Motions for default are under GovBar Rule 5-6F, but this proceeding was not held under that. This proceeding was an actual hearing where the complaint had been answered, and a proceeding was held under GovBar Rule 5-6G.
Ms. Hissom, I don't mean to interrupt you, and I know you're trying to make an orderly presentation, but I think the Chief Justice focused Mr. Walton's argument on the punishment because of the stipulations that are in the case. Maybe following up on that, could you address for us if Mr. Walton's position is that we should really look at an indefinite suspension in this case as opposed to a disbarment, could you focus for us why we should consider one or not consider the other?
And, yes, Your
Honor. And get us to that issue, please.
Yes, Your Honor. A permanent disbarment is appropriate in this case. In addition to the stipulations, there were multiple witnesses, and again, the deposition of the respondent presented in this hearing. There is pervasive misconduct on behalf of the respondent that has lasted many years and involved many people. In just some of these instances, for example, the respondent brought up Joel Jackson. One of the counts pertaining to Joel Jackson was dismissed. One of them was sustained by the panel. The one that was sustained by the panel involved the respondent and another attorney named Cynthia Smith, who represented Joel Jackson in a post-divorce decree matter. That matter involved some pension funds, some investments, the sale of two properties. Respondent did not have Joel Jackson sign a fee agreement, did not tell Joel Jackson how much she would charge. In fact, Joel Jackson testified at the hearing that she was told approximately $29,000. The testimony at the hearing is that not only did what was charged exceed $29,000, at one point in time, there was a settlement from a sale of a property, and the entire sale proceeds from the sale of the property went to the respondent, approximately $20,000. In addition to that, using her position as Joel Jackson's attorney, the respondent had Joel Jackson invest in this real estate investment firm that the respondent was also involved in, went with Joel Jackson to her bank, had Joel Jackson take out $4,800, gave her a receipt which is in the exhibits, which is on like a telephone memo pad, and that was the entire contract for this investment. Joel Jackson never saw that money again.
We've had other lawyers, for example, who have done similar things. I'm thinking recently of a Hildebrandt case where I believe there was a disbarment. Is this parallel to that, or are there other cases you can cite us to that might give us a guide as to what would be an appropriate sanction?
In Relator's brief, we cite four separate cases that were all disbarments. The first case being Marshall, also Julie, and Baylock. Those three cases involve varying degrees of misconduct, but nothing nearly even as pervasive as what is in this case. In the Julie case, the attorney was permanently disbarred for neglecting client matters, mishandling an estate in a malpractice matter, some conflicts of interest, failure to return unearned fees. Didn't even involve as many clients as this particular case involves. The case that Relator cites in our brief that is probably most comparable, we cited the Baumgartner case, which was also a permanent disbarment case. If the court will remember, in that case, the respondent...
Do you think this is comparable to the Baumgartner?
I think it's comparable to Baumgartner in that it involved both activities that she was trying to take in representation of clients. I know it was kind of, you know, what she did was not appropriate, but it also involved some private action that she had taken on her own, which is kind of the hybrid that we're dealing with here, because we're dealing with an attorney who conducted misconduct in representing clients, and also with this real estate investment corporation, which was also one of the counts Rhonda Freeman dealt with, the respondent and this real estate investment corporation, and taking money that was not returned.
Counsel, that's bifurcated, correct?
No, the Rhonda Freeman count is not bifurcated.
But the real estate?
The conviction is,
yes.
But there were counts in the complaint that dealt with her activities as the vice president for business and legal affairs for that company that were not also caught up in the criminal case. There were some separate issues.
Okay.
If the panel has, or if the court has no further questions, I would just request that permanent disbarment is indeed the appropriate sanction in this matter and that the panel and board's opinions be upheld. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Walton, you've used all your time. You may take 30 seconds.
As far as the real estate investment firm, my client was an officer, not an owner in any way, shape, or form, and time reveals it wasn't a real estate investment firm. It had an arm, Sign Joint Ventures, which tried to buy and rehab houses, mostly to try and help poor people avoid foreclosures. That count, as it relates to Rhonda Freeman, was dismissed. The count, as it relates to Jewel Jackson, was dismissed. And I would point out that my client did not receive anywhere near over $29,000. The record is quite clear as to what my client received for representing Jewel Jackson, and it's in there in the findings of fact and conclusions of law. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Walton.